Welcome to State of the State. I'm Matt Grossman with Charlie Ballard and Arnold Weinfeld. We are informing state politics and policy with new research and a check-in on divides within the Democratic and Republican parties this month. So first up, we have a new State of the State based research on how much people think they pay in taxes. And Charlie, does it turn out all taxpayers are above average?
Just like in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, all the children are above average. Most taxpayers believe that they pay a whole lot more tax than they actually pay. Article that's going to get published next month in the National Tax Journal that I wrote with Sanjay Gupta of the Eli Broad College of Business here at Michigan State was based on survey research that we did in the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research's State of the State survey. And we asked people, what percentage of your household's income do you think is paid in federal income tax? And we don't have their tax returns. That would sort of be a violation of federal law. But we know how many people are in the household. We know their marital status. We know their estimate of their income. We can make a pretty good estimate of what their actual average tax rate is. And we came up with a number like 13.9% on average. Our respondents on average said 25.5%. In other words, they almost doubled the percentage. And I think that may be consistent with people feeling that they've been bombarded for most of their lives with messages about how high taxes are. And that may lead to people actually believing that taxes are far higher than they actually are.
Now, Charlie, did that account for age? I mean, did it matter if it was a 30 to 40 year old as compared to a 60 to 70 year old or level of education?
We found if you put it in the statistics and control for a whole lot of all other variables, the elderly tended to overstate by less, a little bit. Married folks tended to overstate by more. All sorts of stories that you could tell about why that might be, but I'm not going to speculate. In terms of other attitudes, we found that people who believe that households like theirs pay too much in tax tended to overstate their taxes, which maybe is not surprising. Also, people who believe that their federal tax dollars are not spent effectively tended to overstate their taxes by relatively more. And in fact, those who use a preparer, an accountant, an attorney, an advisor, tended to overstate their taxes by more. So those are the ones that we found after sifting through all the data.
Mm-hmm. Now, people generally aren't that great at numeracy. So how do we know that this is specific to taxes rather than just people aren't real good at calculating things?
Well, it's very hard to sort out. If somebody says that they believe that they pay 70% of their household income in federal income tax, that could be because that's what they really believe and they're wrong. Or it could be because they don't really have much of a sense of numbers. And there's a whole literature on what we call innumeracy. That is, it's the mathematical equivalent of illiteracy. There are people out there who, if you ask them a question to which the answer involves a number, they simply don't have the training or the equipment to be able to give a meaningful answer. There are other literatures on this. One of the ones is that people tend drastically to overstate the size of minority populations. And again, is that because they're wrong about their perceptions of the reality, or is it because they don't understand numbers? And it's not easy to distinguish those two. But I think it's not just innumeracy. I think it's that people have mistaken attitudes and not just that they have trouble with numbers.
And this may have some political implications as well, as people may see themselves as high taxpayers when the tax cut debates rolls around.
Right. And so we have had persistent political support for tax cuts. And we can argue about whether those were wise. But what's interesting is that at least some of that political support for tax cuts may be coming from people who think they pay a whole lot more taxes than they actually do. And that has interesting implications.
Now, Michigan itself has had tax cuts over the last several years.
Right.
Was this a national survey, or was this out of the state of Michigan?
This is the state of the state survey, which is a sample of Michigan adults. Okay. And this particular sample ranged in age from 18 to 92. So whether this can be generalized to the rest of the country sort of depends upon how typical you think Michigan is. And actually, Michigan is fairly typical in a lot of ways. A couple ways in which we're a little bit less typical, we have a lower than national average percentage of our population that's Hispanic or Asian. We're also below the national average in terms of per capita income. But we're not way out of bounds. At least I don't think we are. And so I think that it's possible to generalize these results and say that if this is what Michigan adults think, it's very possible that this is what the nation thinks.
So as we head into election season here over the next few months, with both the Michigan House and Michigan Senate gubernatorial candidates, I think is it correct to say that given those attitudes, candidates might do well to play to those tax cut tendencies?
Oh, we've already seen. I've seen a TV ad for Bill Schuette running for governor saying that he wants to roll back taxes. He'd like, based on what I think he was saying, it would be a tax cut of about $1 billion a year. He didn't specify what programs he would cut as a result of that, but I think there are a lot of folks who have a visceral belief that if we cut taxes, that'll make life better. And to the extent that they believe that based on an inaccurate perception of how much taxes they actually pay, that's, from my perspective, that's a problem.
Right.
I also have some new research published in American Politics Research with Daniel Thaler that also uses the State of the State survey. And whereas as taxes are generally an area that kind of unites the Republican elites with their base, and where Michigan attitudes might not be that different than national attitudes, we focus on attitudes toward cultural change and racial change. And trying to explain why Michigan was an outlier in its movement away from the Democrats and toward Donald Trump in the latest election. And we were able to pair our public survey with our new survey of political insiders, people who work in state government or in advocacy on state policy. And we found a real divide within the Republicans. That is, Republican elites do not fear social and cultural change. They don't think our values are changing too fast. They don't think our demographics are changing too fast. But the Republican base really does have those attitudes, and they were pretty strong predictors of support for Donald Trump in the latest election.
Right.
So are you saying that the Republican base, what are the particular issues? Is it gay marriage? Is it abortion? Is it immigration? Are those the ones that tend to have more strident attitudes among the Republican base than among the Republican elites?
Well, it's surprisingly, if not issue-less, issue ambivalent.
Okay, that is, so much about particular issues.
Yeah, we can change the policy issues each time. We can talk about gay marriage one time, transgender another time, immigration another time. It's really a broad attitudes that said things are just changing too fast. I don't remember my Michigan or my America like it used to be, and certainly associated with diversification, with increase in minority populations and increasing awareness of different lifestyles like gay and lesbian lifestyles, and the sense that they're being increasingly accepted by society, but maybe not by some parts of it.
And what about on the Democratic side, Matt? What did you see there?
What we find is that the opinions are not overwhelmingly pro-diversity and pro-social change, but they are on that side of the debate, and that's true both among political elites in the Democratic Party and everyday citizens in the Democratic Party. So we really didn't see the same divide or the same kind of strength in opinion within the Democratic base or among Democratic officials.
Which is kind of interesting given the Michigan Democratic Party convention from a few weeks ago down in Detroit, where we saw the progressive side of the Michigan Democratic Party very energized, very active. They fought for and attained the nomination of Dana Nessel as the attorney general candidate over the candidate that was supported by traditional Democratic groups, from labor to African Americans, in Pat Miles, who himself was very qualified as a Harvard-educated attorney and a former U.S. attorney out of the Western District of Michigan. But the progressive side bought thousands more into the convention and prevailed. And I think they're feeling a bit emboldened within the party right now. I also think it presents some issues for the Democratic Party here in Michigan, given that there is no person of color at the top of the ticket right now. We still have a primary to go through in the for the gubernatorial candidate, but with Gretchen Whitmer, the assumed winner of that, it would be three white women at the top of the ticket, and no African American for the first time in over 40 or 50 years, is my understanding. And much has been written about the fact that African Americans are feeling left out. Certainly when you looked around the convention floor at the progressives there, they were overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly middle and upper class, and right now I think African Americans are struggling with that and looking toward the two other gubernatorial candidates, Abdul Saeed and Sri Tanadar, as possible folks for them to vote on.
And this is a very long-term pattern in the Democratic Party, that internal conflicts tend to take the form of descriptive representation battles about what groups are represented within the party leadership, and of issue prioritization. So that is, it may not be the case that those two candidates for attorney general really had strong policy disagreements, but there may have been a perception that, for example, an African American candidate would care more about civil rights, or a female candidate would care more about gender, and those kinds of differences in prioritization are very common within the Democratic Party. So you have on the Democratic side divides which are partially informed by the diversity of the coalition, and also by the fact that people may agree on policy, but they don't agree on which policies are most important. Whereas on the Republican side, you really have a base that is not that interested in passing a lot of policies of any kind, and is more of a backlash to what the Democrats are doing and how society changes over time.
You know, the one interesting thing that has not been talked about in this discussion is that Dana Nessel, of course, was the lead attorney for the DeBoer case, which the Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage. And the fact of the matter is that survey after survey shows that there are many African Americans that are not supportive of the gay and lesbian lifestyle and gay marriage. So I think the Democrats have some issues to move forward on within the party as we get into election season and past the primary.
Does this suggest to you that if Gretchen Whitmer does get the Democratic nomination, as still does seem likely, that it might be wise for her to ask a man and very possibly an African-American man to be her lieutenant governor running mate?
I'd be very surprised if she did not pick an African-American male to be her running mate should she be the candidate after the primary, and I'd be very surprised if it wasn't an African-American male out of the Detroit metro area.
And it turns out this is a fairly common pattern of Democratic parties across the states is this balancing, that if you have a male gubernatorial candidate, you're more likely to have a female lieutenant governor candidate, and it applies to racial groups as well. The Republicans don't tend to have as much when it comes to, obviously, they just have lower diversity in the candidate pool overall, but there also doesn't seem to be evidence that they actively try to balance their tickets in the way that, that Democrats do.
Right. And even after the balancing and after the primary, I think there's going to be have to be some kind of kumbaya with the candidates, you know, showing they're united. I think both Dana Nessel and the gubernatorial candidate, as well as Jocelyn Benson, the Secretary of State candidate, they're going to have to show great party unity amongst the different factions within the within the party, because it is if the Democrats are intent on this blue wave, it's going to take all elements of their constituency together to make that happen. They just can't do it on the backs of African Americans. They just can't do it on the backs of progressives and those that support gay rights. It's going to have to be all those people getting to the poll if they really want this blue wave.
So, Matt, you've sort of portrayed a difference between Democrats and Republicans in that there's less of a difference between elites and the base and on the Democratic side. And yet, Arnold has been talking about some real cleavages within the Democratic Party. Now, I used to say, as the Republican Party, as much of their base lurched toward the right, that we used to have a two-party system, and now we have three parties. We have Democrats, traditional Republicans, and Tea Party Republicans. Are we moving toward a world of a four-party system? Tea Party Republicans, traditional Democrats, and progressive Democrats? Or what do you think the future holds?
Yeah, I think that all depends on, and it's going to be state by state, but one of the things the Tea Party has done over the course of time, or that side of the Republican Party, is grassroots activity. At the local level, for state house, state rep, and congressional seats, I think that's really where the power of the Tea Party has come within the Republican Party. At least right here in Michigan right now, all we're seeing it as at the top of the ticket. So I think if the progressive wing really wants to make a difference within the Michigan Democratic Party, and I'll stick to Michigan right now, they're going to have to find and activate a grassroots network of people running at the local level, whether it's for city council, as I said, for state house and state rep seat. Now we're seeing a little bit of that here in mid-Michigan, where the former mayor of the current mayor of Lansing and the former state representative for part of the city of Lansing has an open seat, Andy Shore. Sarah Anthony, who's an Ingham County commissioner, well-known in the area, well-established political figure, very well-respected, is essentially the chosen candidate for replacing Andy Shore, but yet the Mid-Michigan Progressive Party chair has filed to run against Sarah. So I think we'll see how that plays out. Asked me that the other day, Charlie, right. And I still don't know the name of the person.
The broad pattern is that, you know, the party preferred candidate usually wins in both parties. We hear more about the insurgents because they're more novel. Right. But at least in congressional races, it's about 85% that, to the extent that we can tell who the party preferred candidate is, that they end up winning. We did have a cycle in 2010 and in 2012 where on the Republican side we had higher rates of insurgent victories. It'll be interesting to see if we see that in the Democratic side. But among Democrats, these demographic divisions and divisions over issue prioritization are present both among elites and among the public. So I don't think you'll necessarily see a split between the elites and the public so much as splits between different coalition members. But I think that also may underestimate the positive changes for Democratic unity over time. It really used to be the case that there were differences in issue positions, not just issue priorities, but that the unions and the African-American constituency might disagree about actual policy proposals and might have diametrically opposed positions. And that is less true both among Democratic legislators and among Democratic voters than it used to be. There's actually more agreement across lost more issue positions at both the elite and the mass level. So we'll still see these divisions, but I think they'll be more on the line of what should be pursued first, which will be a big problem if Democrats do gain power, because there hasn't been much of a discussion about what our priorities should be among Democrats, which tends to be a problem with a party that has a long list of priorities.
Right. You know, and it's interesting you say that. I remember during my time as a legislative staffer in the minority for many years, it's always easier to throw the bombs than it is to actually govern, right? So when we finally took control on the House Democratic side after the 96 election, we kind of looked at each other and said, now what? You know, that famous Robert Redford line. And it's a lot of work to be in the majority and to bring your members together on priorities, on issue priorities.
Well, this has been a huge problem on the national level for the Republicans, as for years and years and years it was easy to criticize President Obama on all sorts of fronts, knowing that he would veto things. And then we discovered after 7 years of excoriating the Affordable Care Act, Republicans were unable to repeal it. And so governing is harder than standing on the outside and lobbing grenades.
Yeah. But it takes pretty different forms. I mean, for the Republicans, we tried Obamacare repeal, and then we tried and succeeded in tax cuts.
Right.
And now we're done, basically, on the Republican side. There isn't really a big push to achieve much more, despite full control of the federal government. That is quite a bit different than what you see on the Democratic side, where you kind of see constant pressure to move an additional piece of legislation.
On a variety of issues.
Right. Yeah, you know, I think one of the other things that I've seen, especially out of the progressive side in some other races, for instance, it's present in the race for governor of New York, where Andrew Cuomo has an opponent, is the attack on Democratic candidates, traditional Democratic candidates by progressives in campaign contributions.
Right.
So, you know, you're not a real Democrat if you're taking money from corporate PACs that, you know, represent oil and gas, for instance, and other areas. So that's a dynamic that I think we'll see how that plays out as well, because, of course, the influence of money, the discussion on the influence of money in politics is something that the volume continues to grow. We see that here in Michigan with a ballot proposal by the group Voters Not Politicians to change how we draw district lines to bring it back to a citizen commission of sorts. But that remains to be seen how that turns out.
And they're not imagining it. I mean, there has been a change in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party since the 1970s has become much more reliant on corporate money, either from corporate leaders or from corporate PACs over time, and that has sort of crowded out its more traditional funders. But alongside that increase in corporate donations has been a big increase in mass more liberal donations from members of the public. So the Democrats have a variety of funding sources that can be good for raising money, but it can mean that they have a lot of people to answer to.
Right. Well, and I think one of the reasons for that growth in corporate PACs is because of the lessening of union membership. So, you know, less union membership means less PAC money from unions in general. So I think that's had something to do with it as well.
I think this issue of campaign finance is going to continue to be on the front burner for until this election is done and long after. Just a very recent instance of that was the recent statement by Rudy Giuliani that President Trump reimbursed his attorney, Michael Cohen, for the hush money payment to the adult film actress Stephanie Clifford, known as Stormy Daniels. Giuliani and the president this morning in tweets have gone to great lengths to say, okay, that was not a violation of campaign finance laws, but there are already lawsuits challenging that assertion. And so I think that's the campaign finance is going to be a big issue this year, or at least I think that's likely to be.
Well, it has historically been an issue that a lot of people say they care about, but when it comes down to prioritization, is it your most important issue? It's way, way down on the list.
Right.
And so when it is successfully deployed in a campaign, it tends to be deployed as part of a broader argument about corruption, right? About one side is beholden to the special interests, and the campaign finance is proof of that.
Right.
And that has been successful, but in terms of getting people mobilized to support a campaign finance initiative or something right. like that, it tends to be much lower down on the
That's
list.
That's much harder.
Yeah. Interesting. And given the Michigan ballot proposals, especially the voters, not politicians, which is now looking like it's facing some challenges, it's going to be a question of where those in opposition to that, namely the state chamber and the Republican Party, want to spend their money, whether it's in court trying to challenge it or on the airwaves where I'm sure they'll challenge it. I actually think it might be a bit of a risky play, actually, by the Republican Party and the Michigan chamber to be opposing an initiative that has gained popularity across the country and is on in other states using independent commissions. So I'm guessing they figure if they can stop it in court due to technicalities, then they won't have to deal with it, of course, during the campaign season.
But I don't think the issue is going to go away.
I agree. I don't think the issue is going to go away.
Even if it can be stopped this time, the issue of redistricting is something that is now in voters' minds in ways that it was not a few years ago.
Right.
And it's another funny thing about the Democratic Party, though. They may succeed in changing the rules to not benefit the majority party right about as they gain majority status. Whereas the Republican Party tends not to time it that way.
Right.
They tend to say, well, if the rules benefit the majority party, we'll hang on to them right. while we're in the majority. Whereas the Democrats have this kind of reformist good government faction that wants to pursue those policies while they're in the opposition, but then those goes forward with them even when sure. it might not be to the benefit of their party.
Well, legislative Democrats in the state of Michigan, have been mostly in the minority over the last two decades. So, they're used to playing from that position and not so used to playing from the position of being in the majority. But you're absolutely right, Matt. With the 2020 census on the horizon, certainly Republicans are looking to keep their toehold in both the State House and the State Senate moving forward. We'll have another election, actually, before we actually redraw those lines according to the current rules in 2020. Even though the census is in 2020, it really won't be until 2021 when we actually start redrawing those lines. So,
but not for the Senate, right? So, why is it that, we're in a supposedly blue wave year, or at least potential, and the Democrats, at least at the state level, at the congressional level, we're seeing all sorts of new candidates, but at the state level, the map seems pretty narrow in terms of what the Democrats are pursuing, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of sense that they're even trying to win back control of the Senate.
The Senate, they have a long way to go. 11 members and a 38 member body.
11
at
38 is
very hard. Yeah, so they are focused on winning back the House, but.
If not now, when? I mean, is there going to be another election that comes along when Democrats are going to have a better chance?
To win back the House and the Senate, no. But to win back the House, their time is now. And if they can get one body on their side into the redrawing of the maps, that's a benefit as well. They're making a hard push to do that this election. Of course, the maps are not friendly to Democrats right now. I think most people say, the maps, at least on the House side, show about 60 to 63 Republican seats. But it all comes down to candidates. I've always believed that if you have the right candidate that can truly energize and represent the constituents of a particular district, you can make a go of it. I think the Democrats certainly have been emboldened by some of the special elections that have taken place over the last several months.
And Charlie, what's your takeaway from today's discussion?
Gosh, that's a tough question. My takeaway, I guess, is that we need to revisit these issues again next month and see how things evolve. Because I think 2018 is shaping up to be a fascinating year politically, and I have a sense that long after you and I are in the old folks' home, people will be looking back at this second decade of the 21st century and saying, "Wow, there was a lot of political change in America and in Michigan."
A lot of upheaval.
We're blessed and cursed to live in interesting times. We'll have to leave it at that. Please join us next time on State of the State.